Chapter 17. To Garum Firs, while the possible troubles of Maggie's future were occupying her father's mind, she herself was tasting only the bitterness of the present. Childhood has no forebodings, but then, it is soothed by no memories of outlived sorrow. The fact was, the day had begun ill with Maggie. The pleasure of having Lucy to look at, and the prospect of the afternoon visit to Garum Firs, where she would hear Uncle Pullet's musical box, had been marred as early as 11 o'clock by the advent of the hairdresser from St. Ogg's, who had spoken in the severest terms of the condition in which he had found her hair, holding up one jagged lock after another and saying, "See here. Tut, tut, tut." In a tone of mingled disgust and pity, which to Maggie's imagination was equivalent to the strongest expression of public opinion, Mr. Rappit, the hairdresser, with his well-anointed coronal locks tending wavily upward, like the simulated pyramid of flame on a monumental urn, seemed to her at that moment the most formidable of her contemporaries, into whose street at St. Ogg's she would carefully refrain from entering through the rest of her life. Moreover, the preparation for a visit being always a serious affair in the Dodson family, Martha was enjoined to have Mrs. Tulliver's room ready an hour earlier than usual, that the laying out of the best clothes might not be deferred till the last moment, as was sometimes the case in families of lax views, where the ribbon strings were never rolled up, where there was little or no wrapping in silver paper, and where the sense that the Sunday clothes could be got at quite easily produced no shock to the mind. Already, at 12 o'clock, Mrs. Tulliver had on her visiting costume, with a protective apparatus of brown holland, as if as he had been a piece of satin furniture in danger of flies. Maggie was frowning and twisting her shoulders, that she might, if possible, shrink away from the prickliest of tuckers, while her mother was remonstrating, "Don't, Maggie, my dear, don't make yourself so ugly." And Tom's cheeks were looking particularly brilliant as a relief to his best blue suit, which he wore with becoming calmness, having, after a little wrangling, effected what was always the one point of interest to him in his toilet. He had transferred all the contents of his everyday pockets to those actually in wear. As for Lucy, she was just as pretty and neat as he had been yesterday. No accidents ever happened to her clothes, and she was never uncomfortable in them, so that she looked with wondering pity at Maggie, pouting and writhing under the exasperating tucker. Maggie would certainly have torn it off, if as he had not been checked by the remembrance of her recent humiliation about her hair. As it was, she confined herself to fretting and twisting, and behaving peevishly about the card houses which they were allowed to build till dinner, as a suitable amusement for boys and girls in their best clothes. Tom could build perfect pyramids of houses, but Maggie's would never bear the laying on the roof. It was always so with the things that Maggie made, and Tom had deduced the conclusion that no girls could ever make anything. But it happened that Lucy proved wonderfully clever at building. She handled the cart so lightly, and moved so gently, that Tom condescended to admire her houses as well as his own, the more readily, because as he had asked him to teach her. Maggie, too, would have admired Lucy's houses, and would have given up her own unsuccessful building to contemplate them, without ill temper, if her tucker had not made her peevish, and if Tom had not inconsiderately laughed when her houses fell, and told her she was stupid. "Don't laugh at me, Tom," she burst out angrily. "I'm not a stupid. I know a great many things you don't. Oh, I dare say, Miss Spitfire. I'd never be such a cross thing as you, making faces like that. Lucy doesn't do so. I like Lucy better than you. I wish Lucy was my sister." "Then it's very wicked and cruel of you to wish so," said Maggie, starting up hurriedly from her place on the floor and upsetting Tom's wonderful pagoda. She really did not mean it, but the circumstantial evidence was against her, and Tom turned white with anger, but said nothing. He would have struck her, only he knew it was cowardly to strike a girl, and Tom Tulliver was quite determined he would never do anything cowardly. Maggie stood in dismay and terror, while Tom got up from the floor and walked away, pale, from the scattered ruins of his pagoda, and Lucy looked on mutely, like a kitten pausing from its lapping. "Oh, Tom," said Maggie, at last, going halfway toward him, "I didn't mean to knock it down, indeed, indeed I didn't." Tom took no notice of her, but took, instead, two or three hard peas out of his pocket, and shot them with his thumbnail against the window, vaguely at first, but presently with the distinct aim of hitting a superannuated blue bottle which was exposing its imbecility in the spring sunshine, clearly against the views of nature, who had provided Tom and the peas for the speedy destruction of this weak individual. Thus the morning had been made heavy to Maggie, and Tom's persistent coldness to her all through their walk spoiled the fresh air and sunshine for her. He called Lucy to look at the half-built bird's nest without caring to show it Maggie, and peeled a willow switch for Lucy and himself, without offering one to Maggie. Lucy had said, "Maggie, shouldn't you like one?" But Tom was deaf. Still, the sight of the peacock opportunely spreading his tail on the stackyard wall, just as they reached Garum Firs, was enough to divert the mind temporarily from personal grievances. And this was only the beginning of beautiful sights at Garum Firs. All the farmyard life was wonderful there, bantams, speckled and top-knotted, friesland hens, with their feathers all turned the wrong way, guinea fowls that flew and screamed, and dropped their pretty spotted feathers, pouter pigeons and a tame magpie, nay, a goat, and a wonderful brindled dog, half mastiff, half bulldog, as large as a lion. Then there were white railings and white gates all about, and glittering weathercocks of various design, and garden walks paved with pebbles in beautiful patterns. Nothing was quite common at Garum Firs. And Tom thought that the unusual size of the toads there was simply due to the general unusualness which characterized Uncle Pullet's possessions as a gentleman farmer. Toads who paid rent were naturally leaner. As for the house, it was not less remarkable. It had a receding center, and two wings with battlemented turrets, and was covered with glittering white stucco. Uncle Pullet had seen the expected party approaching from the window, and made haste to unbar and unchain the front door, kept always in this fortified condition from fear of tramps, who might be supposed to know of the glass case of stuffed birds in the hall, and to contemplate rushing in and carrying it away on their heads. Aunt Pullet, too, appeared at the doorway, and as soon as her sister was within hearing said, "Stop the children, for God's sake. Bessie, don't let 'em come up the doorsteps. Sally's bringing the old mat and the duster to rub their shoes." Mrs. Pullet's front door mats were by no means intended to wipe shoes on. The very scraper had a deputy to do its dirty work. Tom rebelled particularly against this she-whipping, which he always considered in the light of an indignity to his sex. He felt it as the beginning of the disagreeables incident to a visit at Aunt Pullet's, where he had once been compelled to sit with towels wrapped around his boots, a fact which may serve to correct the too hasty conclusion that a visit to Garum Firs must have been a great treat to a young gentleman fond of animals, fond, that is, of throwing stones at them. The next disagreeable was confined to his feminine companions. It was the mounting of the polished oak stairs, which had very handsome carpets rolled up, and laid by in a spare bedroom, so that the ascent of these glossy steps might have served, in barbarous times, as a trial by ordeal from which none, but the most spotless virtue could have come off with unbroken limbs. Sophie's weakness about these polished stairs was always a subject of bitter remonstrance on Mrs. Gleck's part. But Mrs. Tulliver ventured on no comment, only thinking to herself it was a mercy when she and the children were safe on the landing. "Mrs. Gray has sent home my new bonnet, Bessie," said Mrs. Pullet, in a pathetic tone, as Mrs. Tulliver adjusted her cap. "Has she, sister?" said Mrs. Tulliver, with an air of much interest. "And how do you like it? It's apt to make a mess with clothes, taking 'em out and putting 'em in again," said Mrs. Pullet, drawing a bunch of keys from her pocket and looking at them earnestly, "but it 'ud be a pity for you to go away without seeing it. There's no knowing what may happen. Mrs. Pullet shook her head slowly at this last serious consideration, which determined her to single out a particular key. I'm afraid it'll be troublesome to you getting it out, sister, said Mrs. Tulliver, but I should like to see what sort of a crown she's made you. Mrs. Pullet rose with a melancholy air, and unlocked one wing of a very bright wardrobe, where you may have hastily supposed she would find a new bonnet. Not at all. Such a supposition could only have arisen from a too superficial acquaintance with the habits of the Dodson family. In this wardrobe Mrs. Pullet was seeking something small enough to be hidden among layers of linen. It was a door key. You must come with me into the best room, said Mrs. Pullet. May the children come too, sister? Inquired Mrs. Tulliver, who saw that Maggie and Lucy were looking rather eager. Well, said Aunt Pullet, reflectively, it'll perhaps be safer for 'em to come. They'll be touching something if we leave 'em behind. So they went in procession along the bright and slippery corridor, dimly lighted by the semi-lunar top of the window which rose above the closed shutter. It was really quite solemn. Aunt Pullet paused, and unlocked a door which opened on something still more solemn than the passage, a darkened room, in which the outer light, entering feebly, showed what looked like the corpses of furniture in white shrouds. Everything that was not shrouded stood with its legs upward. Lucy laid hold of Maggie's frock, and Maggie's heart beat rapidly. Aunt Pullet half opened the shutter, and then unlocked the wardrobe, with a melancholy deliberateness which was quite in keeping with the funereal solemnity of the scene. The delicious scent of rose leaves that issued from the wardrobe made the process of taking out sheet after sheet of silver paper quite pleasant to assist at, though the sight of the bonnet at last was an anticlimax to Maggie, who would have preferred something more strikingly preternatural. But few things could have been more impressive to Mrs. Tulliver. She looked all round it in silence for some moments, and then said emphatically, Well, sister, I'll never speak against the full crowns again. It was a great concession, and Mrs. Pullet felt it. She felt something was due to it. You'd like to see it on, sister? She said sadly. I'll open the shutter a bit further. Well, if you don't mind taking off your cap, sister, said Mrs. Tulliver. Mrs. Pullet took off her cap, displaying the brown silk scalp with a jutting promontory of curls which was common to the more mature and judicious women of those times, and placing the bonnet on her head, turned slowly round, like a draper's lay figure, that Mrs. Tulliver might miss no point of view. I've sometimes thought there's a loop too much o' ribbon on this left side, sister, what do you think? Said Mrs. Pullet. Mrs. Tulliver looked earnestly at the point indicated, and turned her head on one side. Well, I think it's best as it is. If you meddled with it, sister, you might repent. That's true, said Aunt Pullet, taking off the bonnet and looking at it contemplatively. How much might she charge you for that bonnet, sister? Said Mrs. Tulliver, whose mind was actively engaged on the possibility of getting a humble imitation of this chef d'oeuvre made from a piece of silk as he had at home. Mrs. Pullet screwed up her mouth, and shook her head, and then whispered, Pullet pays for it. He said I was to have the best bonnet at Garum Church, let the next best be whose it would. She began slowly to adjust the trimmings, in preparation for returning it to its place in the wardrobe, and her thoughts seemed to have taken a melancholy turn, for she shook her head. Ah, she said at last, I may never wear it twice, sister, who knows? Don't talk o' that, sister, answered Mrs. Tulliver. I hope you'll have your health this summer. Ah, but there may come a death in the family, as there did soon after I had my green satin bonnet. Cousin Abbott may go, and we can't think o' wearing crape less, nor half a year for him. That would be unlucky, said Mrs. Tulliver, entering thoroughly into the possibility of an inopportune decease. Tea, there's never so much pleasure I wearing a bonnet the second year, especially when the crowns are so chancy, never two summers alike. Ah, it's the way I this world, said Mrs. Pullet, returning the bonnet to the wardrobe and locking it up. She maintained a silence characterized by head shaking until they had all issued from the solemn chamber and were in her own room again. Then, beginning to cry, she said, "Sister, if you should never see that bonnet again till I'm dead and gone, you'll remember I showed it you this day." Mrs. Tulliver felt that she ought to be affected, but she was a woman of sparse tears, stout and healthy. She couldn't cry so much as her sister Pullet did, and had often felt her deficiency at funerals. Her effort to bring tears into her eyes issued in an odd contraction of her face. Maggie, looking on attentively, felt that there was some painful mystery about her aunt's bonnet which she was considered too young to understand. Indignantly conscious, all the while, that she could have understood that, as well as everything else, if S.E. had been taken into confidence. When they went down, Uncle Pullet observed, with some acumen, that he reckoned the missus had been showing her bonnet, that was what had made them so long upstairs. With Tom the interval had seemed still longer, for he had been seated in irksome constraint on the edge of a sofa directly opposite his Uncle Pullet, who regarded him with twinkling gray eyes, and occasionally addressed him as, "Young sir." "Well, young sir, what do you learn at school?" was a standing question with Uncle Pullet, whereupon Tom always looked sheepish, rubbed his hands across his face, and answered, "I don't know." It was altogether so embarrassing to be seated tete-a-tete with Uncle Pullet, that Tom could not even look at the prints on the walls, or the fleisages, or the wonderful flower pots. He saw nothing but his uncle's gaiters. Not that Tom was in awe of his uncle's mental superiority. Indeed, he had made up his mind that he didn't want to be a gentleman farmer, because he shouldn't like to be such a thin-legged, silly fellow as his Uncle Pullet, a mollycoddle, in fact. A boy's sheepishness is by no means a sign of overmastering reverence, and while you are making encouraging advances to him under the idea that he is overwhelmed by a sense of your age and wisdom, 10 to 1 he is thinking you extremely queer. The only consolation I can suggest to you is that the Greek boys probably thought the same of Aristotle. It is only when you have mastered a restive horse, or thrashed a drayman, or have got a gun in your hand, that these shy juniors feel you to be a truly admirable and enviable character. At least, I am quite sure of Tom Tulliver's sentiments on these points." Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.